Let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It's February 2nd, 2009. This is the first meeting of the Judiciary Committee of this session, and the membership members here are Senator Terrio, Senator Elton, and myself, Senator French. We technically don't need a quorum to conduct business today. We're just taking a report, but the other members I know have been called, and one member has a bill in another committee. So as they assemble, we'll go ahead and get started nevertheless. We are here today to hear from two folks from the Institute of Social and Economic Research. Their study that they're going to present to us came out of a crime summit we did a year ago. And during that crime summit, we out of my office invited a gentleman named Stephen Oates from Washington State to come to us and talk to us about the efforts he's been making in Washington to use an economic or an economist's perspective on rehabilitation programs and try to assign a dollar value to each dollar you spend on a rehabilitation program to get some idea of what sort of payback you get to society for having invested a dollar in a rehabilitation program. His work was an eye-opener to me, and I was able, with the help of my colleagues, to get some money, $50,000, along with some help from other individuals, to ICER, to have them conduct a Steve Oates-style evidence-based research inquiry into Alaska's rehabilitation programs to see what we can learn. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn over the mics to our two presenters, Mr. Stephen Colt and Ms. Stephanie Martin. We're glad to have you both here today. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee. Please put yourselves on the record, and then go ahead and start up wherever you like, and I can promise you we'll be peppering you with questions as you go along. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we'll both put ourselves on the record immediately, and then I will speak first. My name is Steve Colt, C-O-L-T. I'm an associate professor of economics, and I currently serve as the interim director of the Institute of Social and Economic Research, known as ICER, at the University of Alaska, Anchorage.
I'm Stephanie Martin. I'm an assistant professor of economics and public policy and ICER faculty, also at UAA.
And Ms. Martin, you may want to pull that mic a little closer to you like that, so that the folks in the back get the benefit of the intercom and the PA system. So please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. Thank you for having us. As I said, my name is Steve Colt. I am an economist by training. I earned my doctorate in economics from MIT, and I've been working in Alaska for about 25 years now. You should all have copies, or should be able to get them if you wish, of our report, which is titled, The Cost of Crime: Could the State Reduce Future Crime and Save Money by Expanding Education and Treatment Programs? As Chairman French has already said, this report stems from a visit by Steve Oates approximately 1 year ago. And I should also mention, for those of you not here with us in person, this report is easily available on the ICER website, www.iser.uaa.alaska.edu.
Mr. Colt, let me just interrupt you for a second, because we have, for the viewers at home on Gavel to Gavel who may not have written that down fast enough, we actually, I had my staff put together a little written address of the website. So if you're watching Gavel to Gavel and you want to get a copy of the report, it's available at this website. Or as Mr. Colt helpfully pointed out, you can just Google ICER. But this is the actual web address, and you can find copies of the report there. Thanks, and please proceed.
Thank you. Again, the goal of the analysis was to see if there are ways to reduce crime and save money by expanding intervention and prevention programs that have been shown to be effective. And as you've already said, this work was based on similar work done in Washington, pioneered by Steve Oates. I will briefly summarize our study process and our major conclusions, and then I'm sure that you will have questions about both. Before I begin, I would like to thank and publicly acknowledge the work and the cooperation of the State of Alaska's Criminal Justice Working Group. As many of you know, the working group is chaired by Lieutenant Governor Parnell and Supreme Court Justice Carpinetti, and it includes members from several other departments dealing with criminal justice. In addition to commending and thanking the overall working group. We would particularly like to thank for special cooperation in providing data staff from the Departments of Corrections, the Department of Health and Social Service, Juvenile Justice, and the Mental Health, Alaska Mental Health Trust. And again, I say that without intending to diminish the cooperation we receive from all members of the working group.
Mr. Colt, let me just interrupt you and welcome Senator McGuire and note for the record that she's been in attendance for a few minutes. And now please proceed.
Thank you. Let me expand very briefly on what we all mean or what you and I have come to know as evidence-based policy analysis, which is the technique that was used to perform this study. This method is roughly similar to clinical trials in medicine, and generally it means that we used only the results of those studies where there was a random assignment of people either to a program or to a control group. We did use some studies in which the control group was created by careful matching of program participants with non-participants after the fact. This is also a method that is used in medical epidemiology. It's not quite as good as a randomized clinical trial. And for the most part, we were able to use studies that actually mimicked the medical clinical trial approach of a randomized assignment of people. Having said that, let me just briefly outline the step-by-step approach that we took to conduct this study. First, we made a baseline or business-as-usual projection of prison inmates for the period from now through 2030. Second, we worked closely with the Alaska Criminal Justice Working Group to identify a set of programs that are currently offered in Alaska. And we can go into more detail later about the actual list of programs that we used in the analysis. Step three was we screened this list of programs and we eliminated from our analysis a few programs simply because there was not adequate rigorous analysis available to make a judgment on. And again, we're trying to remain true to the ideals of this idea of evidence-based analysis. Step four, and this is where my colleague Dr. Martin did a lot of heavy lifting, we applied Steve Oss's model and his the empirical results that he had gathered from a review literally of hundreds of studies from around the country. We applied this model to Alaska data on the eligible populations and inmate populations. In other words, we took the OSS model, we took the OSS work, and we tried to Alaskanize it to the greatest extent possible permitted by the data. Step five, basically the final step in the process, we shared our results with the Criminal Justice Working Group. We listened carefully to their feedback, and we did make some adjustments to the analysis based on that feedback. So that was the process. I'm now very briefly going to read our conclusions, and I'm reading directly from our report. Finding number one is that with no change in policies, the number of Alaska prison and jail inmates is likely to double between now and 2030, from 5,300 to about 10,500.
Mr. Oss, just so you can follow, we can follow along, maybe you can tell us what page you're on.
Excuse me. I am reading from the right-hand column. There are four bullet points on the right-hand column of page one.
I see it. Okay, over on the third, on the right-hand side. Thanks. Please continue.
Okay, now bullet finding number two. If the state of Alaska spent an additional $4 million a year to expand programs it already has in place, we estimate that the prison population in 2030 might be 10% smaller than projected. That equates to about 1,050 fewer inmates. Finding number three is when you extend the analysis through time and tally up the costs and benefits in dollar terms. Again, that finding, the state would spend about $124 million for expanded programs through the period, through the year 2030, but by doing so, we estimate that it could avoid about $445 million in cost for for a net savings of over $300 million. It would save money by incarcerating fewer people and thereby delaying future prison construction costs. And I would like to hasten to add that the reason we would be incarcerating fewer people is because they would be committing fewer crimes. Finally, our fourth major finding is that education and substance abuse treatment programs, whether they're in prison, after prison, or instead of prison, would save the state between 2 and 5 times what they cost and would likely reach the most people. We also found that programs for teenagers are effective at reducing crime and saving money, but they seem to reach fewer people.
Mr. Cole, I'll just interrupt you to welcome Senator Wilikowski and let him know that Mr. Colt has just finished reading the findings, which are on the right-hand side of the first page of this report. And just so to be clear, today is the debut of this report. This report has not been sort of fully available to the public until today. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so really what we're sort of having an opportunity to today is sort of for the first time see that an investment of a few dollars can save us thousands a few years out.
That's what this analysis does show, yes. I'm going to finish.
And hold on. Senator Elton has a question.
Do you want to do questions as we go along?
I think that's probably better to stick on Colt, grab a point while the point's available.
With that?
Absolutely.
Just a couple of things, and one of them is very, very basic. I mean, the title of the report is The Cost of Crime, Could the State Reduce? And I mean, was there any kind of an analysis that suggests there are comparable reductions to municipalities, whether it's their police force or people that are delivering social services or school districts, for example, if in fact we make these investments?
Do you mean that we didn't look at school district costs, but we did look at police costs? This study was specifically looking at state spending, so it would have been trooper costs.
So
just as trooper costs would go down, police costs would also go down.
So we can make an assumption that when we talk about the saving $321 million,
yep,
we can make an assumption that there are additional cost savings that accrue to municipalities, which are a taxing authority in the state. Okay. And then second question, Mr. Chair. And you may be getting to this a little bit later on, but the second bullet point is if the state spent an additional $4 million a year, I mean, how did you settle on $4 million instead of $3 or $5 million? And did you run any numbers on whether or not there are additional benefits by going up in spending?
We didn't look at it from starting with the cost. We looked at it for the number of people that we could serve with these programs and the amount by which each program could be expanded. And then we tallied up those numbers, and it came to $4
million.
There's some variation around that number.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, so just as a follow-up, this is almost a policy suggestion that $4 million may be a target of opportunity that should be presented to the legislature.
I'm not sure I understand
I probably. Okay.
Answer, Mr. Chair. I would hesitate strongly to call it a policy suggestion. Senator Elton, you have successfully anticipated a couple of the points that we wanted to cover anyway. Fabulous.
Why don't you go ahead and do so? I mean, while we're on the point, Gary.
Yes. One point is about is this a low number or a high number, and there are several reasons why it could be either. You've touched on a couple already in your question. I believe that these estimates are on the conservative or low side of what would likely actually accrue. For a couple of reasons. One, and actually you've alluded to them both. One is we did not do an exhaustive catalog of downstream savings, if you will, to other law enforcement agencies or other governmental entities. The second reason, which you've already alluded to, and I think that we would like to discuss a little bit how we came to the $4 million number and the program expansions that drive that number. I think you'll have to make your own judgment, but after you hear a little bit more about how that number was arrived at, you'd probably conclude that, yes, there is room for additional expansion beyond what we plugged in to get the $4 million. There is, of course, always the economists' ever-present danger of what we call diminishing returns, and that's another reason why we used a relatively conservative number for the scope of program expansion. The third major thing that I would like to emphasize, it's not directly in this written report, and therefore I really want to emphasize it here, we made no attempt to quantify the cost savings to the victims themselves. Mm. And in part, that's because, as you can well understand, it's a very difficult task to try to monetize those costs. But in this analysis, in these numbers, that cost is zero. And we believe that lends an additional element of conservatism to the analysis. That really concludes my opening statement. And, of course, we welcome your questions at any time. But I did want to ask Dr. Martin to expand a little bit more on the list, particular programs that ended up being considered and going into the analysis.
Dr. Martin, please go ahead.
Okay. We looked at three kinds of programs. We looked at education programs, we looked at substance abuse programs, and we looked at transition programs, which are for people coming out of institutions back into the community. We started with a longer list. As Steve said, there were some programs for which there's not enough evidence to make any conclusions about whether they're effective or not. The programs that we looked at serve different populations. The education programs in the prisons are the adult basic ed and GED programs, vocational ed and job training programs. Substance abuse program, we looked at several in the prisons. Education, substance abuse, which as it exists in Alaska right now, is residential programs within institutions and outpatient programs. And we looked at the sex offender treatment. Within that group of programs, we found interesting finding about sex offender treatment that is effective, but you need to have two components. You need to have a community component, which there is now, and a prison component, which doesn't exist in Alaska. So we put that in on our list of programs. As an aside, sex offender programs are not cost effective. They're very, very expensive, even though they reduce recidivism. You can see on figure 6 in the chart that how the programs rank in terms of how much money they would save and how much they reduce crime. And sex offenders is at the very bottom, along the bottom axis. It does not save any money, but it does reduce crime. So back to our groups of programs, we looked at education programs for young children. We looked at Head Start programs, which serve 3- and 4-year-olds and have unbelievable effects on future crime. But we have...
I'm sorry, say that one again.
Head Start-type preschool mm-hmm. programs mm-hmm. for 3- and 4-year-olds. But it would take a long time to see any effects because we're talking about children who are 3 years old right now, so we'd have to wait for 18 years to see any effects. But in general, the programs that are directed at young people are way more effective than are directed at adults.
And let me just jump in. I'm assuming you build in the time cost of money and the delay, if you will, in the savings or in the reduced crime rate.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. It makes sense. I just wanted to ask. And Senator Terrio has a question.
And since Head Start is the longest existing program, I think, mm-hmm. as far as early intervention, did you pull data from some research that they've done on an ongoing basis?
We used Steve Ose's evaluations of the Head Start program in order to determine how effective it was at reducing crime. His data come from, 10 or 12 studies across the country, random assignment studies of Head Start.
Thank you.
And as an aside, a lot of children education programs don't look at crime as an outcome. So I'm sure there are a lot more other effective programs besides Head Start, but most are looking at high school graduation and teen pregnancy and those kinds of outcomes. Most aren't looking at crime. The transition programs we looked at, are the IDP program, Institutional Discharge Project Plus, which is going on in Alaska. It has a really good recidivism reduction rate, but serves very few people in the state.
Can you put a number? I mean, how many people, if you know or remember? I'm just curious.
That's the people that are in it. I want to say it's about 16 or 17% recidivism reduction.
No, but I mean, how many inmates
how many
are avail themselves
70.
Of that? 70.
70
statewide.
Yes.
And we have a prison population of something around
5,000. And something like around 40% of those people are eligible or mental health.
They're also mental health trustees.
That's right.
So there's some.
So that's a program where it's an example of. We didn't put a giant expansion of it in our model because it's very small right now, and it's not practical to say we're going to expand to the 2,500 people that need it. We looked at alternatives to incarceration, which are the therapeutic courts, the mental health courts, and the drug courts. Those are very effective, and unlike other programs, they have an immediate benefit because they, instead of adding to the cost of being in prison, they're an alternative, and they're way less expensive than the $44,000 a year it costs to incarcerate people. So with those programs, you get an immediate payoff. We also looked at electronic monitoring, which does nothing to affect crime rates, but it's a cost-effective program because you're not putting people in prison. The most expensive way to treat people is to incarcerate them. We found that it's something like $44,000 for adults and close to $90,000 a year for juveniles. In the juvenile offenders, we looked at aggression replacement training, which is implemented in the institutions and is starting to happen in the schools. And we looked at several family therapy programs, and we looked at transition programs. And then for young children, we looked at Head Start. So those are the list of programs. They're all effective. And on figure 6, again, it shows there isn't an if you ask the question, what's the best program, there isn't really an answer because there's a cost dimension and then a eligible pool dimension and a time dimension to all of them. So there are a lot of trade-offs.
And let's just take, for example, adult education. I guess, as a layperson, I wouldn't normally associate getting a GED with reducing the crime rate. So maybe you can kind of walk us through, how big a reduction in crime you get, why that produces a savings to the state, and so forth, just to help me understand.
You get ordinarily, without any programs, about 68% of the people who are incarcerated will return after they're released.
And remind me, is that within like 1 year or 3 years?
That's within 3 years.
3 years, okay. So
and most of that happens really soon afterwards. So about 68% will return without a program.
Almost 70% of the inmates that we let out of prison are going to be back within 3 years.
Yes.
That's the revolving door system we have now.
Yes.
That's Senator Wilikowski.
Do you know what the average education level is in the correction system?
I do. Maybe some. I don't, but it's not. Most people don't have GEDs, I think. But maybe somebody else in the room knows the answer to that. Is anyone from corrections here?
I see him kind of moving in his seat, but it doesn't look like he's running forward to answer the question. So we'll leave that until we get to the corrections subcommittee.
Don't have GEDs.
Yeah.
Or high school diplomas. So back to answer your question, it reduces recidivism by about 70%. So 70, that's about 70% of 7% of 70 is like 5% lower.
You're the numbers, guys.
About 5% lower. So out of every, 100 that come back, 5 fewer will come back. These are small effects. These are small numbers, but over time they become big numbers.
I remember that's what Mr. O said last
year.
He said you can't expect this to suddenly eliminate the crime
rate.
But when you're talking about 5,000 inmates at $44,000 a year per person, just a 4 or 5% reduction, produces dramatic results over time, and that's what you've got to go for. He said you can't look for a Hail Mary touchdown pass. You've got to just get a few yards on each program, and it adds up. Senator McGuire, and then Senator L.
Thank you very much, and thanks for your work. In the area of mental health, you looked at in prison programs and what that could do in terms of assistance. Did you look at or consider what reinstituting some of the community-based mental health programs would do or could do? In other words, programs prior to the event that leads to incarceration?
No, we didn't. We talked about it around the table, but we didn't look at those.
And just in follow-up, if I might, through the chair, was it just the cost of that, or was it too big to get your hands around, too amorphous? Or
the Criminal Justice Working Group came up with the original list, and I think there were programs that were either up for, they were moving through the budget, either they were coming off of federal grant funding and onto state funding, or there were programs that people, that departments were thinking of asking for more money for. We had to limit it somewhere.
Okay.
And I think that, and I think the first step was to take a look at the transition programs and see if those are effective, and then the next step would be to look at community programs.
Okay. Let me just ask a follow-up question to Senator McGuire, and then we'll get to you, Senator Elton. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm interested in mental health treatment, and especially in the transition. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit more about the transition program you did look at, and whether it was for specifically targeted at beneficiaries of the mental health trust, that is the people we would normally say are the mentally ill, or whether it was for all inmates, the transition.
It's trust beneficiaries, but I think Jeff Jesse can answer that question better than I can.
Mr. Jesse, can you help us out?
Sure.
Please come forward, put yourself on the record, and if you heard my question, it was about whether the transition programs that Dr. Colt and Dr. Martin looked at were targeted just for the mentally ill, or whether it was targeted at all inmates, including the mentally ill?
Yeah, for the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And the IDP Plus program is for people who experience a serious mental illness coming out of corrections. So it's not everybody coming out of corrections isn't eligible, but a sizable percentage are.
So while Senator McGuire was concerned about community treatment for the mentally ill, and you couldn't look at that, you did sort of focus in on transition programs for that population.
Yes, Senator French. The working group's directions from the co-chairs was to try to identify a pretty discrete number of programs that could be looked at for expansion. In my view, this wasn't a comprehensive view of how one would put together coordinated strategic effort over time. It was to build that basic understanding of the connection between recidivism and the provision or lack of provision of some of these alternative programs.
Thank you for that amplification. And Senator McGuire has one more follow-up.
Sure. And through the chair, and just in your capacity as you continue to work through it, this committee and the other body over the years just continue to hear strong evidence that many of the folks who are imprisoned in Alaska are mentally ill. And there seems to be a direct correlation with some of the budget cuts. You know, we had the policy of deinstitutionalizing our mentally ill. And then we went to community-based mental health treatment, identification and treatment. And there seems to be some connection between the reduction in those community-based mental health treatment programs and an increasing prison population for those who are mentally ill. And so while I understand the challenges that this particular committee faced, I just encourage you to continue to look at that connection and what we can do as the Senate, as the legislature, to address that issue, because I certainly don't think it's the intent of Alaskans to house our mentally ill in our prisons.
Well, Senator McGuire, through the chair, I appreciate that, and we are certainly doing that. And again, there are a number of initiatives that are out there independent of this effort. For example, the discussion we've had around a housing trust and being able to connect support services to housing, and you know, that's critical. And in fact is a component of many of these programs like IDP Plus, is getting that supported housing. And in fact, the governor's budget has a $10 million set of increments directed towards implementing the first year of the Council on the Homeless's 10-year plan to reduce homelessness. So there are efforts underway. Again, I think what this study does is present that sort of baseline understanding that you can have an impact. on recidivism and the corrections population over time, if you develop a strategic action plan and continue to monitor and manage the initiative. I would not recommend just putting the money out there and saying, okay, in 20 years we're going to have these results. Any initiative like this has to be actively managed. We've learned that in the Bring the Kids Home initiative and the other things that we've done. You have to have a group that's responsible for overseeing the implementation of your strategies and be constantly reevaluating the data and making adjustments over time.
Good answer. Senator Elton, thanks for being patient. Please proceed with your question.
That's okay. And I, Mr. Jesse, I think you may need to be part of the further discussion. We've gotten to a large part of what the question was, but I think you all recognize, and maybe Mr. Jesse can speak to this and perhaps get into what the working group is doing. Because part of the challenge isn't just identifying whether it's 4 million or 4.5 million or 3.7 million that we put into the programs. Part of it is prioritizing the programs and then who delivers the service and who coordinates. And I wonder if you could give us some help or begin a discussion today that would help in the future. Because, I mean, you can if you look at transitional housing, for example, I can see a role for the Mental Health Trust. I can see a role for tribes. Mm-hmm. I can see a role for community groups. But one of the challenges then is when you have an initiative, I mean, who coordinates to make sure that the best entities are out there delivering the services? Is that the working group? Is it some other kind of a structure? How do you handle that part? If you buy into the notion that some of these programs are effective, how do you create then the structure to make sure that you have the right people delivering the services and you have the right kind of mileposts to make sure that the money is being spent as best it can be?
Well, Senator Elton, through the chair, in our experience, again, going back on our successful initiatives such as Bring the Kids Home, you've got to have the key stakeholders at the table taking responsibility for the outcome. And that means you have to have the tribal entities at the table, you have to have the providers, you have to have the constituency, family members and others, have to all be a part of not only just coming up with the strategies, but monitoring their implementation over time. The Criminal Justice Working Group is a great initiator of the focus that this report is bringing to this issue. But by and large, they come primarily from the criminal justice area, and you'll notice that many of these programs are not really criminal justice programs. They're health and social service programs, they're education programs, and although the Department of Health and Social Services has been an integral part of the Criminal Justice Working Group, if you really wanted to implement a strategic plan over time, then you would need to designate some group. It could be an expansion or modification of the Criminal Justice Working Group, but you'd have to identify some group that would take responsibility, and again, for monitoring the implementation and continually revising and renewing the initiative over time, because none of these, in my opinion, are just funding a one-time $4 million increment and then inflation-proofing it and doing nothing else to manage a strategic plan is going to get you there. I think you could well be disappointed when you got down the road and the charts didn't translate into the savings you expected. Mm-hmm. But I think over time, again, if you set those outcomes and you manage towards them, I think you can get there. And in fact, I think you can get farther than this. But understand that this was all the group was charged mm-hmm. to do, was just establish that we know this works. Now, translating it into a specific strategic plan and vision for Alaska and implementing it, that's, as you're pointing out, Senator Elton, taking the next step. Who would be charged with that task, and what resources would they have to to implement it.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I appreciate the answer because, I mean, to use the political cliche, I mean, one of the challenges is the silo effect that corrections does this, HESS does this, I mean, education does this. And so maybe the next step ought to be charging the working group or somebody to come up with, okay, we know what the challenges are, we now have some fact-based evidence on what works. The next challenge for somebody has to be, okay, who's going to make it work? And how do you work across those boundaries? I don't know the answer to that.
I was thinking of someone on the Finance Committee taking that lead, but you know, what do I know?
I can make a recommendation to the chair, Mr. Chair.
We a long time ago sort of jumped into your presentation, Dr. Martin. Is there more to go? Then we can just randomly fire questions.
Questions are good.
Excellent. Why don't we just to make sure we flesh out what we've got here, sort of walk through the figures. I'm on figure one, and maybe just talk us through what these three different, on the first page, just talk us through what these three different lines mean so that we all have a good idea of what it is that we're holding and what we can learn from the data.
Okay, figure one has three pieces of information in it. The top line is the inmate population. Starting in 1981, it shows that the number of inmates in Alaska has increased by 500% over the past about 30 years. The second line in the middle is inflation-adjusted state spending for criminal justice. It's just the operations budget, but it includes, besides corrections, it includes the courts, and it includes the troopers, and it includes juvenile justice. Those numbers are up. But crime rates are down by 30%, and it shows that you do get crime reduction with increased spending, but that it's not dollar for dollar, it's not dollar for percent. That you have to spend a lot more money to get a less reduction in crime, and over time, as you put the more and more of the bad guys in jail, it becomes harder and harder to get those crime reductions by increased spending. The second figure is we looked at the release data from corrections over the past 6 years, and there were 82,000 people released from incarceration. Most of those people, 78%, were incarcerated for misdemeanors, for which you can be sentenced to nothing or probation or up to a year. So most of the people that are getting out and going back in at least started out with misdemeanor offenses. The most serious violent offenders get in prison and stay in prison. We have a strict sentencing system in this state. Those people stay behind bars for a long, long time.
And by those crimes, you'd mean murder, rape, murder, kidnapping, rape, and so forth.
Yes. Let
me just interrupt you and welcome Senator Davis to the hearing. We're glad to have you. And we'd certainly make room for you up here if you'd like, Senator. But if you're comfortable there, we're happy to have you wherever you're happy. Please proceed.
Okay. The figure three on the left is our estimate of how much is being spent on the programs now. The estimate of state spending came from the state budgets.
You mean figure three at the bottom of page one?
Yes, figure three at the bottom of page one, okay. The left-hand
bottom. Oh, I see. Immediate costs.
Immediate costs.
We
estimated that to get the results that we estimated you would need to spend, the state would need to spend $4 million.
So just to put it in context, we're spending about $17 million now.
Right.
Your study sort of assumed a $4 million increase. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if you're doubling or tripling the size of our current programs.
Right.
You're increasing them by about 25%.
That's right.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. And
the middle figure shows that if you have 10 of the 10 people going back to prison after they're being released, if you implement these programs, you can reduce that by about one. These are not big numbers, but over time they add up. The right-hand figure shows that cost of expanded programs, just inflation-proofing them, would cost $124 million between 2009 and 2030, would avoid costs of $450 million, and the net savings would be over $300 million for the state. Most of the savings is in delayed prison construction.
And Senator Elton has a question.
And I'm assuming, too, that most of the savings accrue in the later years, in the out years.
That's correct. And it takes a while. In the beginning, you spend more than you save because it takes a while for the effects to show up, for the people, it's a 2-year lag between the t-
time the program starts and when you would see recidivism.
And I guess it's pointed out, I mean, you pointed this out, but when you say it's going to be 1 in 10, you know, it's not, if you spend this $4 million, it's not as if suddenly the citizens of the state are going to go, wow, there's no more crime in my neighborhood. Thank goodness, you know, they spent that $4 million. You're just not going to see that except for the slow sort of accumulation of the savings and the reduced crime from that 1 out of 10.
Right.
And let me just take a moment and welcome Senator Thomas to the committee as well. Senator Thomas.
Did you want to say something? Okay, figure
4 is on page 2.
Page 2 yep. Shows annual state spending per inmate. It's now currently at $44,000 per person. It was actually higher. Inflation adjusted shows it was higher in the 1980s when the state had a lot more money.
Mr. Chair, may I interrupt my colleague?
Please.
I just wanted to add a somewhat of a footnote to this figure, and that is we're not quite sure that we've pinned down all of the capital costs for the prison system in this number. And so it's another, probably another source of what I mentioned earlier, which is some conservatism overall in what these interventions might do. In other words, that 44,000 might actually be a little bit low. It depends in a kind of complicated way on when we built prisons, how we paid for them, and how we're doing it now.
Thank you for the footnote.
Okay, figure 5 shows that the people that are incarcerated in Alaska, an estimated 90% of them have substance abuse or disorders.
Either a mental health disorder or substance abuse problem or both.
Well, 90% have substance abuse. 30% of that. 60% have only substance abuse issues. 30% have both substance abuse issues and mental health disorders. And there's 6% that only have mental health disorders. And then the lonely 3% or 4% who have neither.
Interesting.
So there's a lot of people who could benefit from these programs. There's no shortage of
subjects. Right. Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Do you have any breakdown on the percentage that have alcohol abuse problems versus the percentage that have drug or prescription abuse problems or other narcotic problems?
I don't. Maybe Mr. Jesse knows that number off the top of your head.
Did you hear the question?
Chair, yeah. I don't know the exact breakdown, but the vast majority are alcohol.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Table 1 follows, and it lists the programs that we looked at, and it's a table showing the size of the population that's currently served, how much we thought we could expand each program, and then the eligible pool.
So just for example, on the first line, education means adult basic education and vocational.
Mm-hmm.
There's about 1,000 inmates currently taking advantage of either one or both of those, and you've thought that reasonable expansion would be 500 inmates.
Yes, that's what we. These are the numbers that we put into our model to generate our estimates.
And I'm just going to, you know, guess that that's not the most expensive program.
It's
a GED.
One of the least expensive programs.
Right, vocational education or a GED have got to be pretty cut and dried. Thanks.
The most expensive programs are residential treatment, but compared to the cost of incarceration, they're less expensive. They save more money, even though their upfront costs are a lot higher. Okay, the next is Figure 6, and we really struggled over how to display this information because there's a lot of information packed in this figure. It shows on the vertical axis for each dollar spent, the state could expect to save. So for electronic monitoring, you get a 22-to-1 payoff. You get a huge payoff, but as it shows on the horizontal axis, there's no crime reduction associated with it.
Now that's kind of interesting. I mean, just to spin it out a little bit, while you're on electronic monitoring, you're not in a $44,000 a year prison cell, so it saves the state lots of money.
That's right.
But you're saying there's no study that shows that someone who's worn an ankle bracelet and stayed home, there's no study that says that they don't go right back out and start committing crimes again as soon as their sentence is up.
Well, there is a study that says they don't go back out. There's a study that tests that, but there's no effect on crime.
So
they will go, just as someone incarcerated will go out, or 68% of them will go out.
There's no difference in the recidivism rate between someone who's home on an monitor and someone who's in a prison cell. They both get out, and you couldn't tell the difference in how they behave later based on that previous experience.
Right. Based on our evidence base.
Right.
According to the study you did.
I would defer to anyone who knows better, but it could simply be that the evidence base is inadequate and that the conclusion is more of an unknown than a conclusion that the number is zero.
Right. I guess you'd want to test that some more, because you could leap to the conclusion that everybody ought to be on an ankle bracelet, right?
Unless you want to reduce future crime.
Maybe. Okay. I think I probably better stop there and go to someone else. Senator McGuire, and let me just welcome Senator Ellis. Thank you, Senator Ellis. Pleased to have you here.
No difference.
Senator McGuire, then Senator Elton.
Thank you. And through the chair, are there any studies, it's occurred to me in the past, that the group to ask that would be interesting are the, I guess you would say, the 22% that don't reoffend. Mm-hmm. Are there any studies out there that have been conducted that take the population of folks who don't reoffend after that three-year period, and ask them, what were the significant events? Was it treatment? Was it an ankle monitoring program? Was it a transitional housing? Was it someone giving you a break, a job? Was it family support, church support, those types of things? Are there any studies like that?
I'm sure, but I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. Just something I think for us to keep
curious.
In mind.
I'm
curious, you know, curious. What that might be the way to get at that question.
Yeah. What works? Look at the people that are successful.
And Senator Elton.
Thanks. I want to go back to the ankle bracelets, because I guess I was a little bit surprised to find that lumped in with the other education treatment kinds of things, because I've always thought of electronic monitoring as being just another form of incarceration. And that lumping it in with treatment would assume that they're incarcerated in a different way, but they're not receiving any treatment at all to help reduce recidivism.
Well, the way that we thought about it was we tried to put them in as concise a groups as we could, because they're kind of all over the map. But we put it in that group only because it doesn't incur the cost of incarceration. But you're right, we could have split it out differently, because it's not a treatment. But it is a way to save the state money.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It doesn't have the same effects.
Good. And just going back to that figure six, for the folks at home, it says here that Head Start for young children saves six times more than it costs and reduces future crime among participants by about 16 percentage points, which is the most effective of all the programs you looked at.
That's right.
Head Start.
That's right.
Senator Wilkowski.
Just a question on your percentages. Is that when you have the percentages along the bottom part, you said it reduces it by about 16 percentage points?
Right.
Is that dropping it from 38 down to 22?
Yes.
Okay, so
take
that's
the percentage points, yes.
Okay, so that's actually a drop of
a lot more.
40% or so.
It's 42% or something.
Furrowed brows. I know you're right, but we all have to kind of go back to high school math to make sure we're on the right track.
For this
right.
Stuff
for us.
How many billions?
Please proceed. So that's figures.
And what's figure six shows is the programs, the farther to the right you are on the bottom axis, the more effective they are at reducing crime, and the higher up on the y axis, the bigger the cost savings. So there's a lot of trade-offs. Figure 7 is a wedge from the reduction.
Figure 7 is the bars.
Right, but the total of the bars, the entire triangle, is the over time, the 1,049 fewer inmates that we projected. And this figure shows how much reduction we expect from each program type. because they don't all have the same effect on the prison population. It depends on how many people they're serving. It depends on their effect on recidivism. So that it tells along the right-hand column how much each program will reduce crime. Like for preschool programs, it costs about $1,000 per child. It saves about six times that much. But we wouldn't see any effects from that program for a long, long time.
I see. You go out almost.
Right. You go out till they're 18.
Right.
So you start seeing effects.
So from 9 to 20, yeah, 9 from 25 is 16.
Right.
Right.
And at the bottom, for comparison, are programs like therapeutic courts that take people, they divert people from the prison system. So right away you would see a reduction in the number of inmates.
And let's look at the biggest one. The biggest one is the red segment, and just describe those so we make a good record.
So the education and job training programs in prisons, and the reason it would have such a big impact is because it can reach the most people.
And they only cost $1,000 each?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be a big, because it can be expanded easily. It's not the most effective program, but it's the easiest to expand.
Relatively inexpensive run. Senator Wilikowski.
I remember from Mr. Oust's presentation last year that one of the most effective ways of reducing, or cost-effective ways of reducing crime was to help foster kids. And I don't see anything on here about that. And was that something that you looked at, or is it not?
Will you say that again, sir?
From Mr. Oust's presentation last year, I recall that him showing us studies and statistics that funding for foster care kids had a huge, I think the largest impact of anything at all. I think it was $73 for every $1 spent. And I don't see anything here. Is that
we
something?
We did not look at that program. It wasn't on our list. I think there are some impediments to implementing it in Alaska. The other program that's unbelievably effective is the Nurse Family Partnership Program that sends nurses into households of low income, either expectant mothers or new moms. That has an unbelievable effect on recidivism. But the group decided that it's not practical or possible to implement it in Alaska. I'm not sure what the constraint was. Maybe nurses? I'm not sure. And so those are on OSA's list. There are more effective programs than these, I guess, is what you're saying. But these are the ones that are here and are expandable. Okay.
How about figure eight?
Figure eight is the starts at the beginning, and the top line is our forecast of the number of inmates we expect starting in 1971 and our forecast to 2030. And then the bottom line is the reduction in inmates if we implement at this level that we've proposed, which is, it's just an estimate. I mean, the number could go up or down. And we see that there would be 10% fewer inmates in 2030 than there are now. And the big financial benefit is not that we would not have to build any more new prisons. It's that we delay the prison construction. Because right now we're looking at every 6 or 7 years building a new prison, and that's if they're house 1,500 inmates, which for Alaska is a really big prison. And if we implement these programs, we can stretch that out to every 9 or 10 years. And at $300 million per facility, that's a lot of money. That's it.
That's the report. Thank you. Other questions from members of the committee? Don't hear or see any. I think it's interesting that I just happened to have in my email inbox an invitation tomorrow to the signing of the contract to build that new prison. That's going to happen tomorrow. That NESR Construction and the borough are going to sit down and sign the contract for the construction of the new correctional facility at Point McKenzie. So I think it's timely that you're here today to tell us about some alternatives to having to crank those prisons out every 8 or 9 years. Sounds like you have a point, and Mr. Jesse has his hand up. We'll let him talk.
I wanted to say also about the Mat-Su prison is that it's scheduled to open in 2012. Part of the program in the Mat-Su is to bring home the people who have been sent to Arizona to serve their time in Arizona facilities. Those 900 people combined with the increase we expect to see of 600 inmates will make that prison full just about when it opens.
The day it opens.
So we are sort of behind the curve already.
Mr. Jesse.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might just go back, one of the programs that's not on the list that was mentioned was the visiting nurses program for at-risk families. Mm-hmm. Alaska had an alleged replication of that. It was called Healthy Families. And we had six different variations of it around the state. And the Mental Health Trust invested nearly $500,000 over 5 years to have Johns Hopkins University evaluate the outcomes from that program. And it didn't work. The data demonstrated that it didn't work. And so just putting money at a strategy that on paper says is going to be effective and then expecting it to get the results that you intended doesn't necessarily get you there. And we actually came to the legislature and said, you know, unless you change this program, you're wasting your money. You need either fix it and make it work or stop funding it, you know, and the decision was made at the time to stop funding it. It doesn't mean that the model isn't a good one. It's just if you're going to invest in it, you have to have somebody paying attention to whether it's being implemented with fidelity to the model and whether it's getting the results that you intended. Another example is with, again, Bring the Kids Home, which is a similar strategy. We had a program called the Alaska Youth Initiative, which were wraparound services to kids to keep them in state and in their homes. And over time, it degenerated to a not cost-effective or efficient way of delivering service. Basically, we're recreating that now as a part of the Bring the Kids Home initiative with individual service dollars to do essentially the same thing. The difference is we learned from the last time that you have to keep tripwires in place to identify when these programs cease to be functioning as they intend. So I think these strategies are good ones. There are others that are out there that could be implemented. But again, I just want to emphasize, if you don't maintain rigorous oversight and have somebody responsible for the outcomes, you can invest a lot of money and be disappointed in the end.
Wise words. If there's nothing else to come before the committee, thank you for being here today, and thank you for traveling to Juneau, and thank goodness that the weather allowed us to have this right here in this nice committee room. We're adjourned.